Bob, that was quite a meditation. Now I'm worried about 2098, I think it was. What do you know that I don't? All right. Sometimes the meditation and the talk are sort of interwoven. And sometimes in music, it's all kind of a single stream, and that's kind of what I feel is happening right in this moment. And you'll see where I'm going. This mic sounds kind of weird. It's like crackling. I was going to ask you, is that a problem? What are you going to do about it? Do you want me to switch to this one? Yeah. It's bothering me, in other words. Okay, now I'm going to have to stand at the lectern here. All right, I'm going to begin with a reading, and then we'll get into it here. This is by Martin Buber. Not that I'm claiming I understand what he's talking about, but anyway, here's what he has to say. The life of human beings is not past in the sphere of transitive verbs alone. That's a grammar reference. It does not exist in virtue of activities alone, which have something for their object. I perceive something, I am sensible of something, I imagine something, I will something, I feel something, I think something. The life of human beings does not consist of all this and the like alone. This and the like together establish the realm of it. But the realm of thou has a different basis. When thou is spoken, the speaker has no thing for his object. For where there is a thing, there is another thing, and another thing, and another thing. Every it is bounded by others. It exists only through being bounded by others. But when thou is spoken, there is no thing. Thou has no bounds. When thou is spoken, the speaker has no thing. He has indeed nothing. He takes his stand in relation. Yeah, there you go. See you next week. I've tried to read I and Thou, that's from Buber's book, several times. I mean, the first time is when I became infatuated with Judaism and Abraham Heschel, and he kept quoting Buber, and they would have these conversations, and I was like, who is this guy? And I read it, and I thought at the end, I have no idea what any of this is about. And I've since returned to it a few times, and for some reason it came into my mind this week, and I thought, I'm going to look at Buber again, and it seemed to turn me in the right kind of ways. I was like, oh, so he's saying something very important here that I couldn't quite hear before, and that's what I want to sort of dance with today, and I'm coming to you as a, actually, I don't know what I am, I'm just a human, I guess. I'm not trying to speak as a scholar. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an existential philosopher. My background is in religious studies and biblical things and being a human. All right, so the place to start is 1633, as you might have guessed. And 1633 is when Galileo was put on trial for being a heretic. And it was a bit of a confusing time and a kind of a delightful time to be alive, much like today. And his basic claim, as you know, Galileo's basic claim was that the earth wasn't the center of the universe. He said the earth is spinning, and not only spinning every day, but also revolving around the sun. And this was problematic. And it was problematic for the Aristotelian view of the universe, which was quite straightforward, in that the earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around the earth. And you know how they, how Aristotle concluded that, or why Aristotle concluded that? Because he just looked around. And that seemed to make sense, you know? Along with really most myths, legends, stories, narratives, creation accounts, had something like that. I mean, I'm not being very, what's the right word, literal here, but it was something like, we are here, and everything out there seems to be revolving or moving around our center. And that kind of makes sense. That's how you experience the world. That's called your head, your brain, your eyes that you're looking out of. Of course, we then think the world must be like that because that's your world, you know? Okay, that makes sense. And of course, ancient creation stories, this is pre-Aristotle, were not scientific. I mean, that should go without saying. They're not science documents, although they're wrestling with the trouble of existence. Why are we here? What are we doing here? What is the nature of reality? What does it look like? So anyway, Galileo was, I just thought of the Indigo Girls. Galileo's head was on the block. He wasn't actually killed, by the way. He was put in prison. He died of like some heart problem in his 70s. He continued to write. That was always, by the way, the funny thing with the Catholics who were always putting people in prison. Some people they killed, but they're like, you can't say anything. But then they're like, you can keep writing, you know. This happened, I'm serious. Many mystics were told, shut your mouth, you can't say anything at all, keep writing. And then, you know, eventually this stuff trickles out. And that kind of happened to Galileo. And his view was more or less was thought to be in conflict with the Bible. You know, Aristotle's view was thought to be in harmony with the Bible, and that mattered a great deal during this time because it was really the Bible was a kind of spine for Western culture, and so this got him into hot water, and maybe I want to mention something about being a Homo sapien. Sapien means wise. David Dean was reminding us that. We named ourselves that. Part of the Homo erectus genus. And it's a fact, we could say, of human consciousness that we're self-reflective, that we have an ego, to use modern language. It just seems to be a fact. We're self-reflective. We're conscious of the fact that we're conscious. And we're conscious of the fact that we observe reality, and there's something like an I and an it. To come back to Buber, to start dropping hints about Buber. I am over here, you are a bunch of its out there. And I'm observing and seeing, and that seems to tell me something about the way reality is. And it's a gift. It's a blessing and a curse. I mentioned something about the ego last week, that the fact that we can imagine is one of the great gifts and curses of being a self-reflective, conscious Homo sapien. Because you can think to yourself, this is getting really long. I wonder what I could do for lunch. And there you are at lunch. It's like amazing. And, or there you are back in childhood. I mean, what a weird thing human consciousness is. And all of the great stories and legends, including Galileo, he's not a myth, I suppose, was wrestling with the reality of human consciousness. And why are we here, and how do we get here, and what is the nature of reality? And here we are, apparently being dwarfed by a black hole that is, according to Bob, 1 million times larger than the sun. What? Yeah, what do we do with these things? So actually, that's one of my points, that Galileo was raising a much deeper problem. He was uncovering a much deeper problem that maybe is the trajectory of human consciousness anyway. Things grow in complexity. That's the nature of evolution, from simple to complex. And why wouldn't it be the case with human consciousness? And we're bumping into larger and larger things. It's actually quite disturbing to really sit with, you are not the center of the universe. Because you are kind of the center of your own universe, Like, I'm not the center of the universe, and I'm the one saying that. Oh, I know that I'm not the center. Okay, says the center of the universe. So he was raising a much larger problem, and a series of problems. I won't go into them all, but just to mention a few, like, where are we in the story then? If we're not the center, where are we in the story? Like, what is the story then? If we're not the center of the universe, if the earth isn't the center, if the universe does not revolve around us, then what is it doing? And it's not just a particularly scientific problem. It's an existential problem. You can feel the angst associated with it. Because science could come along and has, in leaps and bounds, tried to explain it differently. Okay, we're not the center of the universe. We're revolving around the sun. And the thing with the sun is that it's a pretty small star in a pretty minor solar system inside a small galaxy, if I'm getting it right, called the Milky Way, which you can occasionally see, which is among millions of other galaxies, millions of other galaxies. And so you're like, okay, that makes sense. All right, good. Now I know. No, that's just increasing facts and also with it the existential angst, I think. My feeling is, well, then what are we doing here, you know? And why? And why would we even be upset if there was a war in Ukraine? There's a black hole that is a million times larger than our sun. Who cares, you know? And so I'm, the title of my talk is supposed to be Homo sapiens, Pinnacle or Cancer. And I'm taking the extremes. I think we live right now in a culture that is like in love, like has a deep craving for extremes. But most people aren't really in the extreme anyway. I mean, really any issue at all is filled with nuance. Wouldn't you agree? And even if you're like, I am a fill in the blank, one part of you might say, well, sometimes I'm not like that. You know, life is complex. But right now, that's what sells. Extremes is what sells. And we're kind of given this as, I'll just highlight the extremes, having said that. One extreme is that human beings are the pinnacle of creation. Here we are at the very top of everything. And you could say, if you're religious, God made it that way. It's the great chain of being. We're at the top, and everything else is a resource for our disposal. And how do we know that? Because we're in charge. That's how we know that. Except if I dropped you off in the middle of Lake Michigan, right in the middle, and said, are you in charge? You might feel a little different. So anyway, that's the sort of pinnacle. We're the pinnacle of... And that's that is probably somewhere in your field of awareness, even in your outlook, even if you might deny it. It's somewhere hidden in there. And then you have the other extreme, which is we're just an accident among accidents, no different than a black hole or a flea among millions of other, billions of other its and bacteria. There's no scale, there's no balance, there's no hierarchy. And right now, it appears that as a species, we're a cancer on the earth, and the earth would be better off without us. That's an extreme view. But it's not too many steps removed from just stating the facts of a series of its. So is it a scale? Is there a pinnacle? Is it flat? You can feel the extremes. I'm not going to answer that because you know, like all my talks, I'm going to say it's something like both. But I want you to feel at least the cultural tensions, and they're actually quite hidden. Sometimes they're out in the open, but they're quite hidden. And what are you attracted to, and what are you drawn to? And here's something they both have in common. They both are still functioning in the I-it relationship, in Buber's I-it. It's a series of its. That's an interesting phenomenon. The pinnacle is, I'm at the top, and there are a series of its and resources, and the more flat view is also, it's just a series of its. We can't overlay it with any kind of ethic or morality. That's all meaningless. And of course, as Hume was sort of joking about, and also real, saying something is meaningless is meaning. I just believe there is no meaning. Well, that's a meaning. Like that, it, like it's funny. It falls back in on itself. It's like that Bright Eyes song. Not that you necessarily would know this, but I have to think of the line. He says, you say there's no truth. How come you say it like you're right? He says, you say there's no truth and who cares? How come you say it like you're right? You know? So, well, I don't know. It's part of human consciousness. We crave that meaning, even if we're going to say it's meaningless. That gives us like a sense of place. Funny. Anyway, okay. So 1613 was the beginning of a problem. And now we're just adding to it. And what's the Earth? Like something like 4 billion years old? I don't remember. You tell me. 4.7. I was going to say 6. Like, from my point of view, as I kind of read the data, I sort of think 4.6 is more likely. But, you know, just... I mean, I'm not perfect, you know, or a 14.5 billion year old universe, you know, it's like, we just say like, oh, yeah, this is the case. I mean, what does that mean? What does that do to what is essentially a human-centric standpoint? Like, it's disturbing. It is disturbing. So I think it's okay to feel disturbance. And of course, whenever there's a massive disturbance in worldview, you have those who are on board with it, sort of, and you have those who resist it. It's like, let's put Galileo in prison so we don't have to hear this nonsense. And so we would expect that to be taken, to be dethroned. And that's really the way I would view it. I would put it in psychological terms. It's a dethroning of the ego. And you're a blip on the radar screen. You're a vapor. In 2098, you'll all be gone. So, please don't quote me on that. Quote Bob. Yeah, it's a dethroning of the ego, and it takes time for us to wrestle with such things and to allow the new state of affairs to work on us, I guess we would say. Let me look at my notes and see if I've mentioned anything so far that I wanted to say. I guess I'd like to say that the two options were the pinnacle of creation or that we're the problem and it's much more like a cancer. I'm going to say neither one of these work very well. The both options seem too narrow. And they both share a kind of inflation, that's the psychological term, or a kind of arrogance. And they both say, well, I know, you know. Well, I know. The way it is. It seems to lack the kind of humility that's required, I think, to really be affected, and not only individually, but the human species. I'm saying we have problems right now. The human species is causing problems. We cause problems with one another and the Earth community. So we need a shift in consciousness, which everyone keeps saying. Well, how? Well, part of what shifts the consciousness is allowing new realities to break us down and to work on us and to undo us, and that's what we call transformation, and or adaptation, if you want to use a more Darwinian word. We need a kind of adaptation of human consciousness, and these things take time, and a dethroning of the ego is probably a good thing. By the way, are you familiar with the flat Earth thing? You know, one thing I find funny about it is that one of the arguments is, well, when you look out at the horizon, it's not curved. So for some reason, that makes me laugh. But what's also funny is that when people say, well, I know it is round, because when I look out at the horizon, it's, well, I guess it is kind of flat. Or, oh, I know that it's round. Well, do you feel how, like, limited the human ego is? How do you know the Earth is round? Oh, I've seen pictures from space. Okay. You know, on your computer. It's a dethroning, in a way. So... okay, let's get to Buber. He says, I'm going to try to do this as clearly as I can. There are two ways that we experience existence, or two attitudes is his technical term. And attitude number one is I, it, and attitude number two is I, thou. These both exist. It's not like some people are into the thou and other people are into, it's not a Democrat, Republican thing. It's just, he's saying that they both exist. And it is about facts. And it's toward the object that is separate from us. I see you over there. You're separate from me. I don't know what you're thinking. I can look at some of your faces and guess, but I don't really know. You're an object to me. And more than that, this is an object, and this is an object, and this Taylor guitar is an object. I'm guessing that's not the one you were, that's a hand-me-down, your first guitar. Okay. Because that'd be nice for a first guitar. Object. Again, great gift of human consciousness. That's the I-it realm. Like she, he, tree, those are its in the subject-object realm, or a series of objects, we would say more to be more precise. And we're rooted, we're grounded in this I-it dynamic. I mean, was it last week? 2 weeks ago I gave a talk and I mentioned Annie Dillard. I read that passage where she sees the tree and it's like on, seems to be lit from within, and she has a kind of like numinous, mysterious, that's what I would call it, encounter. But it's a tree, right? It's an it. It's an I-it. We could run it through the lens of Annie Dillard and the tree, the object of the tree. And one of the things that Buber says is that the I-it has different modes of categorization. I'll just mention some, such as the aesthetic. Like if I stand and look at a tree, I can have an aesthetic experience. The light comes in a certain way. I could even feel a certain way because of the aesthetic reality. And it's a reality. It's part of what I'm observing about the way things are. He says I could observe it through the lens of movement. Like it might be swaying in the breeze a bit, or it might look like it's going to fall over, because maybe it is. I don't know. It could be. And when the wind blows, you know, this kind of thing. That's the realm of movement or categorization. We could say, well, it looks like a tree because I've seen other trees, but it's different than this tree because of the shape of the leaf and the way, you know, so forth and so on, categorization. And we could even go all the way down to, all right, this is a black walnut, but within the realm of black walnuts is this particular black walnut on this particular spot of land. So it is an it, very specifically. And we can change our perspective. We could cut the tree down and flatten it out, you know. And have you ever been to like a natural history museum where they pin things down and label them? And it's kind of like amazing and eerie at the same time. And that's part of changing our perspective. I could look at the tree from above or below or any number of ways. This is all in the realm of I-it. And we can run it through mathematical sequences. It's all just math anyway. It's like music. That was a beautiful song. Well, technically, it's just math, you know? And if the math was wrong, you would hate it. And right now, there's a lot of bad math in the realm of music. Okay. This, of course, has been enhanced, the I-it, in the scientific era, which we should celebrate. These capacities. Objects, resources, its, things, facts. The other realm is I-thou. And thou is about relationship. In relationship in which the other is not separated by discrete bounds. Thought I'd give you a quote. The other is not separated by discrete bounds. There's a blurring that's taking place here. This is also the realm of meaning for Buber. Because if you only live in I-it, you're only living in categorized ways of describing objects. It's like if I fell in love with someone, if I fell in love with my wife and I said, I love you, and she said, why? And I said, because you meet the categories that I require for the proper object. Yeah, see, it makes you uncomfortable. It might also be true. Like, I love you. How do you know? Well, because I'm flooded with endorphins right now, and that my synapses are firing, and whenever they fire, I just really like you, you know. I mean, all that stuff is true. It's 100% true. It just feels limited, right? Because it tends to turn the other into an object. So you already have a kind of instinctual reaction toward the only I, it, as a way of relating to the world. It doesn't feel quite right. It doesn't explain things like love very well. So Buber says meaning rests in this realm, in the I-thou. And that our relatedness is what gives life meaning. And funny thing, even moving rock piles is a question of relatedness. It's not like a question of just math. It's relatedness. It's like, am I in relationship with place? Am I somehow in the place? Where do I begin and the place end? Those are starting to move toward I-thou. So relationship is the perception. Now we get kind of philosophical, almost poetic. Relationship is the perception. It's not perception doing something to the object, but the relationship is perception. It's a way of perceiving reality, if you want to put it that way. And he says, one can have an I-thou experience with anything, a stranger. He has an example of a stranger, a complete stranger. You can be caught up in your interrelatedness. He actually says it requires a certain amount of spiritual or mental effort on your part to relax into such a thing. He starts to sound like a mystic. He starts to sound like, well, I guess a mystic would be the best way to put it. And you know this feeling. Like, why do you care about people in Ukraine? Do any of you speak the language? Have you ever been there? Maybe some of you have, I don't know. Why? Why care? Do you even know what's going on? Well, just by bringing a stranger to mind in a certain way, the possibility of thou comes into focus as a relational perception. I am somehow not other than is the felt experience, not the thought. That's I-thou, or getting close to it. He's describing a kind of spiritual stance, really. Okay. So here's a quote from Buber. When thou is spoken, the speaker takes his or her stance in relation. When thou is spoken, you take your stand in relation. It's like when you say to someone, I love you. Do you feel how you're taking a stance that's relational? Not just object, subject, object, resource. I love you because you are a great resource for my needs. That's not going to make it into one of those songs. Maybe in a poor mathematical song, but that's not going to cut it. You know that. It doesn't feel right. So I, thou, you have some intuitive sense of the reality of such a thing. By the way, here's an aside. I don't have a lot of time for an aside, so I'll make it a short one. Most of the people, when they think... Well, I should back up. One of the things that Buber says is the ultimate I-thou is God. That there's an eternal thou, and we stand in relation to the eternal thou whenever we say thou. In other words, his name for God, if you want to put it that way, is thou. And it's a stance. And it can't be run through the I-it dynamic. Because if you say, does God exist, and you treat God as an object, then you conclude God doesn't exist. He's not an object, or she's not an object. How do we know that? Because you look around. That's how you know that. So he says it's the wrong realm, really. I'm paraphrasing, but it's the wrong realm. It's the wrong kind of posture. So anyway, that's just a... You can sort that out at lunch. Okay, so what can we conclude? I'd like to suggest that we need an I-thou stance, which I would call a spiritual stance. I mean, we call ourselves a spiritual community, and we're always asking, well, what do we mean by that? And part of what I'd like to say is it's a cultivation of a certain stance in the world, a certain posture in the world. And we don't ignore the objects that need to be addressed and dealt with in science and facts and math. Of course not. We pick up trash on the side of the road because those objects are ugly. But the stance that in part needs cultivation, I might suggest, is a thou, as an I thou. It's part of why I keep wanting to use a word like sacred. Sacred reciprocity. Well, that's a question of relationship. And that's a question of thou. And so Martin Luther King understood this very well. So if you read his a letter written in the Birmingham jail, he quotes from Buber. And you know what he says? That the fundamental problem is a spiritual stance. That black people are viewed as its, in an I-it relationship. And none of this will change until the stance is taken of I-thou. Doesn't that seem true? Yes. So this isn't just abstract, you know, I'm just now going to think pretty thoughts. It's very concrete. If you begin to feel yourself in relation as a spiritual stance, the world changes. And suddenly it's not those people as objects that are higher or lower than where you might be. Okay. I'm going to read two paragraphs. So I try to get the end of this talk more precise. So, I thou, I want to suggest, amounts to one of the greatest spiritual crises of our age. It's my suggestion. Because we're losing our taste for the thou. To stand in an attitude of relatedness takes a spiritual stance where the object fades. And it's perhaps the greatest invitation we have right now. It's essentially a spiritual problem. How we treat the other, any other, and the earth as other, that's a spiritual problem. If that's the only way we treat anyone or anything. And we need to cultivate this I-thou, in my opinion, to speak thou and thus to stand in relation. To speak thou and thus stand in relation. All of our fighting is between its, it fighting it. And the cultivation of the thou just turns things. It's a kind of religious posture or spiritual posture. It is. You might come up with a different word for it, and that wouldn't even bother me. But that's the realm that I think it was discovered, we could say. So we must have the courage to really allow the otherness of the other to be, first of all, and thus discover our relatedness. That's the kind of irony about it. By letting any other it be itself in its beingness, we can find ourselves in relationship to it, like a tree that suddenly is luminous and lit from within, as Dillard was saying. Buber, by the way, claims that this can happen anytime, with anything, anywhere, at any moment. There's no like special thing that's needed. Like, I don't know. I can't even think of anything. The ego is not on the throne when we find this mode of being. And that's probably the most important thing I'd like to say. It's not on the throne of its own mini universe when this mode of being is cultivated. And what else should a spiritual community be about than helping cultivate such a stance and such a posture? So at least in my view, the future depends upon it. Thanks for listening.